for Representative Schrader out of the E Board long enough to join us for some voting. So with that, I'm going to turn some time over to Legislative Counsel, Mr. Chamoff.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. First, members, a quick overview of our agenda. Assuming we were to proceed in order, we'd be approving the minutes from the two previous meetings. I'll be giving a brief report on the highlights of the past session, what we're working on during the interim, give an explanation of the administrative review process that the committee goes through. There will be a vote in block to accept those reports that our office has found rules to be within the intent and scope of the implementing legislation. There will be separate reports on the rules where we've identified a problem. The typical procedure is that the attorney with the expertise in the subject area will briefly present the report to the committee, and then there may be a written response in your materials from the agency, or the agency has the option of appearing in front of the committee and explaining the actions that the committee took. The committee takes separate votes whether to accept the report of our office on those rules. Once we've concluded that, there will be the presentation of service recognition awards honoring people who have worked in our office for significant amounts of time.
Great. Why don't we then go to the, we'll hold off on adopting the minutes until we have a full quorum of the committee. So why don't we talk about committee duties and then move into a review of the 2001 session and the work of the office.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For those of you who have your notebooks, behind the tab under committee duties is a short list of those things that the committee is charged with doing.
They didn't give us notebooks.
Say what?
We didn't get notebooks, but we did get materials.
Oh, materials.
Anyone
need
any materials?
Yeah.
I have mine.
Okay, so in your materials, but your materials not being in a notebook, you have a sheet labeled Legislative Council Committee Duties. Your main tasks are to hire and fire the Legislative Council and make sure that the Legislative Council is doing his job. Certain hiring decisions, attorneys and managers within the office require the committee's approval of my decision. The committee sets policies for our office's actions, including our bill drafting procedures, our personnel rules, and the processes through which we prepare the Oregon Revised Statutes and other publications. All of those policies have been adopted by previous committees, so there's no action required of this committee at this time, unless and until some need to change the rules arises. The main task that you'll be undertaking throughout your tenure on this committee is reviewing executive department administrative rule reports. Shortly before elections, you will be preparing explanatory statements for ballot measures. The law requires this committee to prepare an explanatory statement for every measure as a backup in case the Secretary of State's committee can't agree on its statement. As a practical matter, we prepare the first draft that's used by the Secretary's committee, and then that committee works off of our draft. But because our committee's statements could end up in the voter's pamphlet, we do send those out to the committee for review before we send them to the Secretary of State. And then finally, from time to time, this committee may direct the Legislative Council to represent legislative interests in court. We've included in your materials the summary of the statistics from the 2001 session, and it shows a comparison of number of bills and things that have how they've compared to past sessions. highlights are there was a record number of measures introduced by the body that was achieved despite a significant decline in measures in the Senate, was more than overcome by a record increase in the House of Representatives. I'm pleased to report that we prepared for introduction for the Assembly measures in record time. You had twice as many measures ready to work when the session started as in the previous session, and many more than in any other session. And that trend continued throughout the session. The legislature adopted the budget that the committee requested, which was in recognition of the dearth of funds available, 0.5% below current service level. There were no increases in the budget, and in fact, we worked in a slight increase. Behind tab entitled Summary of New Laws, we've put together short explanations of the changes in the statutes that affect the work of this committee or this office. Most of them are technical, and I don't propose to go through those at this time. Leave those to you to peruse at your leisure. During the interim, although most places in the building are somewhat empty, our office is not. We are at full session staffing because we are in the process of preparing the volumes of the Oregon laws and the Oregon revised statutes. That's a roughly 6-month process that begins when the governor has concluded his time for vetoing bills. I haven't seen the official color yet, but the 2001 Oregon revised statutes should be a bright burgundy of some kind to distinguish it from the blue ones that you most recently received. We intend to have a booth at the Oregon State Bar Convention. For those of you who will be there, we're going to be using that opportunity to inform the profession of some of our specialty publications and see what we can do to get information about how to improve our products and how to increase their sales, because the sales of publications is a substantial part of the budget for our office. We'll spend a great deal of time in the interim preparing administrative rule review reports for this committee. We will be working with Legislative Administration Committee's Information Systems Department to update our computer systems. The indexing system that we use was built in the 1970s. It runs off of the Department of Administrative Services mainframe computer. Our docketing system is on paper, so that's how we keep track of what's in the office. Our bill drafting system was built in the 1980s and runs off of a mainframe computer, and as the legislature is migrating to more modern technologies, we're hoping to update our systems as well, because that will enable us to provide us or provide you with substantially better service. We will also be working with members to find ways to improve the service that we provide to you. In June 2002, we will begin drafting measures for executive department agencies. Today and tomorrow, I'm going to be meeting with various caucuses to discuss our MATA issues and how some portions of our current constitution would fare if challenged as not being validly adopted. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court will hear argument in the Powell case, and I'm not expecting a decision soon after that argument, given the significant issues that are currently on the Supreme Court's docket.
Can I just stop you and ask, Greg, is the Powell case the only case where a legislative council is currently involved in representing the interests of the legislature in court? Are we involved in any other legal action at this point?
Mr. Chair, not at this point. The Powell case is the extent of our court work.
Okay.
Can I have a question about that? Didn't Didn't you either intervene or become involved in a case in Multnomah County Circuit Court, the federal redistricting case?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, we initially started down that path, but because not all legislators who were parties to the case had consistent positions, it was inappropriate for us to represent any one of the members in the case. Last I knew, the Attorney General was representing the Speaker and the President, and the Senate and House minority leaders had retained private counsel.
Thank you.
Are there any questions for counsel on either the committee's duties issue or on the statistics issue? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I'd just like to ask counsel if, in light of the workload of your office, which I think is tremendous, and you know, the services which you provide, which are extraordinary, whether you have any feeling as to whether there should be limitations on the number of bills introduced in the Senate and House. I know at the end of last session there was a bill came before the House. I think it had a little bit of currency with it, but didn't pass. Is that something that you'd like to make a recommendation about, or like to have that come from the committee, or what would be your general views?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, my preference at this time would be to work with Representative Williams in meetings with leadership and with other key members to try to come up with some institutional changes that would allow us to decrease our workload and therefore improve the timeliness and quality of our product without having to go through some a measure quite as draconian as limiting the number of measures that a member could introduce. For example, we encourage members to allow us to talk to other members when other members request bills that are substantially similar to those that the first member requested. For example, you're quite good at giving us that kind of permission, and that helps cut down on the number of times we'll do bills with related concepts. Other members are not quite as good at sharing, and to the extent that we could change that, that would help significantly. And hopefully working with Representative Williams, we can come up with some more changes like that that wouldn't require anything quite so substantial as a change in law or rule.
Chair?
Yes, Senator President.
We, in the Senate, introduced fewer bills since, what, 1985, this past session, because we asked our members not to introduce so much legislation and not to pass so much, to try to do better with what we had to work with. Also, we tried hard last session to say, let's not put names on bills, which would make a tremendous difference in how bills were handled. But again, we weren't able to get the House members to go along with us on that area. I think that alone would reduce the number of bills introduced substantially, and that's a fairly minor change. So perhaps next session that could be discussed, and I think would make a big difference.
Thank you, Senator. For members of the committee, I opposed, as most of you know, strongly what I think was called House Bill 4000, which would have limited the number of bills that a member could introduce, because I thought that it limited one of our primary functions as legislators, which is the ability to introduce and bring a bill forward. But I also made the commitment that I thought that the Legislative Council Committee during the interim ought to examine whether by rule or some other method, changes that we could make, which would limit the number of duplicate bills and, at times, I think what all the members of this committee might agree, frivolous bills being introduced. So I would like us to have that conversation during the interim. I've asked council to put together a list of options, you know, from sort of one end of the spectrum to the other, of things that this committee might consider to recommend a leadership between now and the beginning of next session, to see if we could put in place some procedures which would do the very thing, Senator, that you were suggesting, that would limit the number of bills, duplicate bills, and bills that frankly don't bring much to the process. I do believe you have to counterbalance that with each individual member's right as an elected legislator to represent their constituents and to bring forward issues that are important to them and to the people that they represent. And somewhere in that balance, I think we can strike a place that will maximize the use of the resources of Legislative Council's office without over-constraining our members. Senator Minnis.
Well, I was thinking years ago I visited the House of Commons in London, and the back of the speaker's chair, there's a big leather pouch, which is a place where the people in England can drop in their requests of their government. So perhaps we could put a big envelope at the front steps of the Capitol, and the citizens can bring their requests and drop them in the pouch. But
sort of a suggestion box.
Well, no, I'm saying that kind of facetiously, but what I'm trying to say is that really it's not our power, it's not our primary function as legislators. It's the right of the people,
right,
to bring ideas to their government. And so, I mean, I find this argument or this discussion somewhat intriguing, but to me, if you limit the privilege or the right of a legislator to introduce a piece of legislation, you infringe upon the rights of free speech of the individuals that they represent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not saying that there shouldn't be some reasonable bounds of rules, et cetera,
right,
et cetera, but I think there has to be an opportunity for citizens to introduce legislation, so to speak, and that they do that through their legislators. And so, absent some other methodology and trying to minimize the effect of some initiative petitions, I think people should have the freedom and feel privileged to come in here and talk to their legislators and have legislation introduced. I think once they're introduced, then it's up to us in this process to sift through those ideas. So,
yeah, I think you've said it very well, Senator. I couldn't agree more. Interestingly, in talking to people in other states about this issue, you know, there are some states where a member can introduce as many bills as they want. But there is a all-powerful committee called the Printing Committee, and you can introduce, and I think Idaho is this way, you can introduce all the legislation you want, but then there is a committee which all legislation must pass, and that committee determines whether or not a bill will actually be printed. And if it's not printed, then it can't move to the desks. Now, I'm not recommending that for us, because I don't think that that's a system that would necessarily be congruent with how we think this process ought to operate. But there are a number of different models that are used throughout the states in this issue, and that's one of the things that I'm going to ask council to do, is to examine. He belongs to the Association of the Legislative Council's offices around the country and in other democracies. It would be interesting to see if there are anything that we might glean from their operations that might be something for us to consider. I would envision doing that, committee members, probably not in the next meeting, but maybe the following Legislative Council meeting after we've had a chance to get the information. And I'm going to suggest to council that as we develop information, we disseminate it to the members so you have an opportunity to think about it and you're not just struck with it here in a meeting where we're going to actually talk about what we're going to recommend to the leadership offices. But I think it's a worthy discussion, and I think certainly because of the traction that Senate Bill 4 or House Bill 4000 got in the House, and also the efforts that Senate President Gerflor made in limiting the number of Senate bills, I think it is an issue that is important, and I think this is the committee that ought to address it. Is there any other comments on either the statistical information or the duties of the council?
I have one brief.
Yes.
Two brief ones. Thank
yes,
you,
Council.
Chair. To follow up with Senator Durfler's comment about the restraint in the Senate, but for the efforts of one member, the number of bills that came out of or went into the Senate, depending upon how one receives that would have been at its lowest level in roughly a generation. And two, our office at an appropriate time will be presenting awards to the members who requested the fewest drafts. In the Senate, that was Senator Carter and Senator Duncan. In the House, that was Representative Hayden and Representative Patty Smith. And so when an appropriate opportunity arises, we intend to invite them to attend a committee meeting and receive our thanks for their restraint.
Okay. Well, we now have a quorum, so I'd like to move back up to the top of the agenda. And the first order of business on the agenda would be the approval of the minutes from the two previous Legislative Council Committee meetings. Is there any discussion about the minutes by any of the members? I know some of you might not have even been members of the committee at the time that those minutes, at least in the first meeting, were done. I reviewed them and found them to be accurate. Any comments?
Do you need a motion?
Yeah, I do, Senator.
I'll move approval of the minutes.
Senator Minnis has moved the approval of the minutes of the December 21st, 2000 and the May 3rd, 2001 meetings of the Legislative Council Committee. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? Representative Walker.
Chair Wilson, I'd just like to comment for the record, in case anyone is looking at this, that the Representative Walker that is listed on the minutes for December 21st was actually Vicki Walker. I did not come into the legislature until January, and I just didn't want someone to think that I was attending a meeting that I was not yet a legislator.
Does it reflect just a Representative Walker?
Just as Representative Walker. Now, the other minutes that I did attend, May 3rd, it does say Representative C. Walker.
And I think that the trick there would be, Representative, that you weren't a member.
Correct.
As of December 21, 2000, so as
right.
Someone reflected on that, they would know that that would be the only Representative Walker at the time. But
we can add a V.
But I appreciate you pointing that out. Okay, the motion is to approve the minutes, and any further discussion? Any objection? Minutes are approved. We've had the statistical summary discussion, and now we'll move into agenda item number 3, the administrative rule review. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You have among your materials a report of the Legislative Council Committee to the 71st Legislative Assembly on administrative rule review that gives a brief narrative of how the administrative rule review process works, plus explanations of the key rules that the committee reviewed during the past interim. The way that administrative rule review process works is executive department agencies must submit copies of the rules that they adopt to the Office of the Legislative Council within 10 days of the filing of the rules with the Secretary of State. That is an absolute statutory requirement. If the rules do not get to our office within the 10 days, the rules are invalid. We then assign the rules to the attorneys with the expertise in the subject of the rules, looking for a couple of things. First, is the rule within the authority granted by the Legislative Assembly in statute? And two, is it within the authority that the people granted in their constitution? We do not review rules to determine whether the agency's policy decision was good or bad, only whether the policy decision was within the discretion that the legislature or the people granted to the agency. And if you look in your materials, there are a couple of sheets about, one's labeled administrative agencies and rules, the hierarchy that explains sort of how we get to administrative rules from a constitutional command to the legislature to act to a legislature's command to an agency to act. But the second sheet is labeled agency rulemaking authority, and it gives a couple of examples of how the legislature authorizes an agency to adopt rules. The first grant is to the Secretary of State, which, if I can summarize, is go forth and do good. It's virtually impossible for the Secretary, given such a general rulemaking authority, to ever adopt a rule that's outside the scope of that grant, because the Secretary is given the authority to adopt rules that the Secretary considers necessary. And we're unlikely to be able to second-guess that. The other example is a very specific grant where the legislature has told the State Board of Education to adopt a rule, and the rule's going to have these particular elements to it. And when the agency adopts a rule, we can compare the statute to the rule and see whether they match. And it's with statutes like that that we're most likely to find that the agency did not act within the intent and scope of the implementing legislation. Over time, and the number has stayed consistent over the decades, 98% of the submissions that we receive, we find the agency acted within the authority granted to the agency. And those are the rules that we ask you in these meetings to adopt in block. That's item 3B on your agenda. Roughly 2% of the time, we will submit a report suggesting that the agency adopted a rule that the legislature or the people did not authorize the agency to adopt. Almost all the time, that unauthorized rule comes from the agency simply misreading the law, adopting a rule that provided for some right to last 2 years when the legislature had said, make sure the right lasts for a year, that kind of thing. When we find a problem with the rule, we invite the agency to submit a written response and to appear if the agency desires to present its views to the committee. And as I explained, we'll have the lawyer who hopefully prepared the report or at least is expert in the subject matter explain the problem to the committee. If the agency representative is here, the agency has the opportunity to explain the agency's point of view, and then the committee votes on whether to accept the Legislative Council's report. If the committee does vote to accept the report, this committee can't change the rule. There's no power for the legislature to change an agency's rule except through the passage of legislation. What happens is I send a letter to the agency saying the committee found that your rule was not authorized. Would you please tell us what you plan to do about it? 90% of the time, the agency changes its rule in response to the committee's determination. 10% of the time, the agency says, no thanks. We'd like to keep our rule just the way it is. We don't care what you think, in which case the typical response from this committee is to introduce legislation to override the rule. In your materials, you've got specific numbered administrative rule reports that include our report, plus if we received a response from the agency, it's in those materials. The numbering sequence, there's no magic to it. As a rule comes into our office, a rule submission, a packet, it could be anywhere from one to a couple hundred rules, we assign it a number, and have since the time that we began reviewing administrative rules. And so you can see that, you know, we're now in the process of reviewing somewhere in the range of the 17,500th rule submission to our office. Any questions about how the process works?
No, Senator Minutes.
And not the question how the process works, but has there ever been a recommendation by this committee to constrain or limit the rulemaking authority of state agencies, or to give them more clear guidelines in terms of crafting of their rules to, I guess, narrow that large window that appears in general rulemaking authority?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minutes, frequently the committee will suggest legislation to help clarify a specific agency's rulemaking authority, where, for example, the agency has taken an action that the committee believes should be taken, but that the legislature hasn't provided the agency with enough authority or clear enough authority to take that action by rule, and will then, the committee will then introduce a bill to help the agency achieve what the agency would like to achieve. But as far as a overhaul of the rulemaking process, not to my knowledge, no.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
Do agencies have the authority to make rules if it's not specifically mentioned in the statute? If there's a new statute and it's silent on the issue of rules, does the agency have authority, or how do they make that judgment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, no, the agency does not have authority to adopt rules unless the legislature grants that authority.
There are further questions? Okay. Item B would be the motion to adopt the administrative rule reviews 17-401 to 17-600.
Except those with negative determinations.
Except those with negative determinations. And we've got those individually listed below that we would handle.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Minnis. Senator Minnis has moved the adoption of those administrative rule reviews, with the exception of those which we have individual staff reports on. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, those administrative rule review reports are adopted. And now we'll move into item 3C on the agenda, which are the separate staff reports. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the first staff report is ARR 17421 involving a rule of the State Parks and Recreation Department, and Mr. McCarthy from our office, who prepared the report for you, is here to illuminate the issue.
Thank you. Mr. McCarthy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brendan McCarthy, Deputy Legislative Counsel, for the record. This is one of the technical glitches that Council spoke of just a moment ago, stemming from a change in the 1999 session when all infractions were changed to violations. The State Parks Department changed a number of their rules to reflect that change. The Parks Department enforcement statute allows the department to assess a Class A violation to a violation of a rule adopted by the department. There's also another statute which allows an agency, if it chooses, to assess a lower level of a violation, a B, C, or D, to a specific rule or specific violation. And the Parks Department passed a rule which said, and generally, any violation of a rule is a Class A, B, C, or D violation. Because I believe the Parks Department needs to specify which rule is which violation, they exceeded their scope of authority by just broadly saying that all rule violations would be a B, C, or D violation. Parks Department is here if you wish to question them, and that is the sum total of my report.
Mr. McCarthy, did the Parks Department provide a formal response?
The timeline on this, Mr. Chair, was relatively short. I believe my report went out only about 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
So in place of that, they are here today.
Well, let's bring up the Parks Department. Would you stay, Mr. McCarthy? Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Neifert, and I'm with Oregon Parks and Recreation. It's good to be here today.
Jim, what do you think about Legislative Council's office's analysis of your rule?
We're comfortable with their position they took, and it appears from our analysis based on Mr. McCarthy's testimony here that we'd be able to go back and make some minor changes on it. Our intent back in the year 2000 was to bring in compliance where all of our rules were under infractions to bring them under the violations. That was solely as a housekeeping intent. And it appears that we would be back within that scope of authority if we remove the B, C, and D within this particular OAR. And we'll have our AG's office take a look at that, and then we should be able to be back in within the compliance. The intent behind why we made that change as well, we got a call from the Department of Justice back in early 2000 that said if we don't make the changes in the OARs, we'd be issuing violation notices at a minimum of $600. And we would be afraid that our campers and our visitors in the park system would not appreciate having a violation notice for $600 for not registering their vehicle or what have you. So that was our motivation and our intent behind it.
Okay. There are questions? So it sounds like you're going to make it all work out, and you'll respond after you talk to the Department of Justice, to Mr. McCarthy, with some formal notification of the action that you anticipate the department to take.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay, good. Any questions, counsel? Anybody else? Good. Thank you very much for coming
today.
Thank you.
Yeah, I now need a motion to approve the report on ARR 17421.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
I move that we approve the report on ARR 17421.
Representative Walker has moved approval of ARR 17421. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The report is approved. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next reports should be combined, ARR 17423 and 17573. One's a temporary rule, one's a permanent rule, both involving the state fire marshal, and Mr. Taylor is here to explain this issue.
Mr. Taylor, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Chuck Taylor, Deputy Legislative Counsel. This is a state fire marshal rule. The statute we're dealing with creates three types of licenses for people that handle liquefied petroleum gas. The statute provides that two of the license types are valid for 2 years at a time. The third license type is to be valid for 1 year at a time. The rule made all of the license types valid for 2 years. The fire marshal agrees the rule is incorrect, and they hope to have a replacement rule ready to be filed with the Secretary of State in time to be published in the October bulletin.
Okay. Are there questions for Mr. Taylor? Great. Thank you, Chuck. We are now short.
We are now short
a member. Why don't we put this aside and we'll move on to the next one, and when we get Senator Minnis back in the room, we'll move through the actual adoption of the report. So let's take the staff update on the next one, Council.
Mr. Chair, ARR 17476 involving the Health Division is normally an issue that Holly Robinson would take. She is out of the office, and so I'll be presenting the report on her behalf. The Legislative Assembly set the fee for a particular kind of hospital license at $2,900. The House Health Division's rule set the fee at $2,500. Informed of the mistake, the division filed a new and corrected rule, which may have taken care of the problem. The only issue I would note is that the division did not provide the new rule to our office within 10 days as required by law, so I suspect that we will see this rule again at a future meeting with a report suggesting that it's invalid for failure to have complied with the procedures for adopting and enforcing a rule, but the rule that they adopted did take care of the 2,900 versus 2,500 problem.
Have you been in conversation, or do you know if Ms. Robinson has talked to the DHS about their timeliness issue?
Mr. Chair, we got a letter from the Department of Human Services saying that the department had been advised by the Department of Justice that the Department of Human Services, since it was simply correcting a typographical error, didn't need to follow the rulemaking statutes. That's not a position with which we agree, and we only received that word yesterday, and we'll be having additional discussions to see if we can't help them arrive at a view of the law that's closer to our own.
Okay. Is there any discussion about ARR 17476 by the committee? And I don't think we've got anybody here from the Department of Human Services to talk about this rule. Okay. Can I have a motion on the report?
Would be on 17476.
Right. Senator Durfler has moved the acceptance of the report on ARR 17476. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, it's adopted. Let's jump back up to the reports that Mr. Taylor presented on ARR 17423 and 17573. Is there any discussion? Okay, the chair would move the adoption of the reports on ARR 17573 and 17423.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
I move adoption of ARR 17423 and ARR 17573.
Okay, Representative Walker has made the motion. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Those reports are adopted. That takes us, Council, to 17573. 03, is that right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Public Employees Retirement Board, an issue of some complexity that Mr. Hendricks will be helping us with.
Good morning, Mr. Hendricks. It's a pleasure to see you.
Good morning, Chair Williams, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. Mr. Chamoff is correct. Mine is not quite so simple. In fact, it's a rule that's in the middle of litigation right now in a Marion County Circuit Court case. It's a report that, frankly, if I could have dodged, I would have, but I think that the statute's pretty clear as far as what our responsibilities are in looking at rules, and I would begin by saying that the good news is that there is no way that my report or any action by the committee with respect to the report should have any effect with respect on the litigation that's currently pending on this specific rule. The rule in question relates to the distribution of earnings on the Public Employees Retirement Fund. Every year in March, the Public Employees Retirement Board makes a decision about how to distribute earnings that the fund has earned during the previous year. It's an important determination for purposes of the members because when they decide how much was earned and how to distribute it, it has an immediate and direct impact on the retirement benefits of the members. And that's because one of the calculations, and the one that's been used in about 95 or 98% of the cases of the last few years, has been the money match calculation for PERS benefits. It says basically that the member is entitled to a retirement benefit that is of a value that's equal to the amount in their account, matched which with a similar amount as put in by the employer to match that those that amount that's reflected. So it's an important issue, and it's very large numbers. The amount of money involved here is in tens of millions of dollars with respect to this particular rule, even for 1 year, the 1 year we're talking about, 1999. And even though in PERS calculation, tens of millions, when you're talking about a $50, $60 billion fund, it may be small by comparison to the overall amount, it's still a lot of money. The rule that we're looking at here was adopted in 2000, and the reason the rule was adopted was because we'd at that point had 2 or 3 years of very high returns on the fund. We had that roll of years there at the end of the 90s when the fund was earning a lot of money. members have two ways in which they can basically decide to have their money treated in their account. They have a regular account, which is just take my money and put it in with all the investments that PERS has, and I will take the average earnings that comes off of the fund, whatever that may be. So they put their money in, and whatever the fund earns, that's what they get. The alternative is something called a variable annuity account. And basically, that's just what it comes down to is that's an account in which your money basically is going to be directed more towards higher risk stock investments. Less than half of PERS is invested in stock. That's by statute. They can only put a maximum 50% of the PERS fund into stock. If you go into the variable annuity fund, a larger proportion of your account, the member's account, is going to be attributed to those stocks. And thus, you're going to take a higher gamble with respect to what your final calculation is going to be. It could be really good in good years, or it could be really bad in bad years. And not only that, you're going to give up by making that decision the thing that many members have, the so-called guaranteed 8% return, which, you know, if you have service before 1996 in PERS and you have money in there, if you just decide to leave it in the regular account, statute says we're going to say you get at least 8% earnings on that, even though the employer may have to pony up more money in order to make sure that money's there to pay the guaranteed 8%. What happened was, and this was the principal reason why the lawsuit was brought, is that because of those 3 years of incredibly high earnings, employers their monies were not being invested in the same manner as the employees was for purposes of the variable annuity account. Employers were receiving the same amount that the whole fund earned. And usually, like in that particular year, 1999, that we're talking about, I think the regular accounts earned like 21%, I think is what they earned. The variable annuity investments earned like 29%. And underneath the way that PERS had been calculating the way they were going to distribute these funds or how they calculated the account, PERS had always taken the position and still does take the position that the employer, even though they're only earning the 21%, when you do the money match calculation for purposes of the member who retires who's got maybe 75% of his account in the variable annuity, that the employer had to meet that. Well, so the employer had to meet 29% earnings, even though the money they had in the fund was only earning 21% by the distribution formula, and as a result of that, they were suddenly way in the hole and had to come up with a whole lot of money, forcing local government, state government, everybody else to kind of come up with a whole bunch more money. So that was a huge problem, one which the legislature, this last legislature, addressed in part in Senate Bill 134. But this year, rule is still looking at what the situation was in 2000 when they decided to make this call. What the rule said was, rule did a couple of different things. But basically what they said was is that, and you have to understand that, the Public Employees Retirement Board doesn't decide how the fund is invested. They do have control over that. The decisions on how the fund is invested is made by the Oregon Investment Council, which is a separate body over which they have no control. The Oregon Investment Council makes real decisions about which stock and which other types of investments, and they've done a great job, as everybody knows, over the years first. Because PERS couldn't simply say by rule, gee, we're going to go ahead and change the way in which these things are invested so that the employer is going to be investing in the same manner that the employee's funds are, what we're going to do is we're going to pass a rule that says we will distribute the money on the assumption that the OIC will in fact invest it in the way in which we are going to distribute it. And we're going to distribute it as though the employer had a similar amount in those riskier variable annuity investments as similar amounts to what the employee put in. And then we're going to go ahead and we're going to contact OIC every year and say, we're doing this. And would you please take that into account in making investment decisions? And the OIC, my understanding was starting in 2000, and I was told this at the time as well, the Oregon Investment Council said, fine, we're happy with that, we'll do it. And they started in year 2000 to begin investing higher amounts in these riskier variable annuity investments so that the employer's experience on return would track the employees. That was the intent. And, in fact, Senate Bill 134 now mandates that the Oregon Investment Council invest those monies in that manner. That's what 134 did, was to make it clear that rather than having this rule out here that says PERS is going to ask OIC to basically invest in this manner, we now have a law that says, OIC, you shall invest it in that manner. Okay, I think, so the... From 2000 on anyway, the monies were basically invested in this manner, and this report doesn't challenge any of that, doesn't say that's a problem. Because as long as the monies were invested in that manner, and an employer accounts and in fact had that experience, there's not a problem, just as there's no problem with the provisions of 134. The problem was that in 2000, when they adopted this rule, the board decided, made a decision to make the rule retroactive to 1999. And so what they did basically was say, look, even though the monies weren't really invested in those higher amounts, those employer monies were not invested in those higher investments, we're going to treat it as though they were. And the net result of that, immediate result, was that the earnings on regular accounts dropped in order to basically shift that money over to the credit of the employers with a impact on the calculation for the purposes of the members.
David? Were you going for, I didn't want to interrupt you, are you going for your close?
I'm close.
Is that it?
Yeah, well.
Let me see if I can synthesize this in a way that I can understand it, and hopefully it'll be a way that others can follow along. Essentially, the problem is that the agency adopted a rule and then applied it retroactively beyond what their statutory authority allowed. That has since been fixed with respect to Senate Bill 134, but at the time they applied it to their 1999 operations, they did not have the statutory authority to do so.
And that's correct.
And that's what we've told them.
That's correct.
And is that also the basis of the lawsuit that they're involved in right now with the Eugene Municipal Water and Electric Board?
Chair Williams, correct. Although it's actually several different issues in that case. That is one of the issues, and Judge Lipskin in the case on this particular rule basically held that he felt it was an invalid rule.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. There's a formal response from PERS in the file. In essence, because it's in litigation, they, of course, are staying with their position that it's a valid rule, and they had indicated they would not appear today, which is understandable as well, given the fact that,
right,
that it is in litigation.
Questions of the committee for Mr. Hendricks on what, at least for me, is a scintillating issue? I wonder about the rest of you.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, that gets into the merits of their suit a little bit. But what is the remedy, David? If the rule is deemed to be unconstitutional or outside their statutory authority, is invalid, what happens?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, the decision in the Marion County Circuit Court was on a motion for summary judgment on the legal issues. So basically, the judge said, I think the rule is invalid, and then he set it over for additional proceedings on the remedy.
Mm.
It seems to me that with respect to this particular issue, the remedies that they're probably going to require is that basically PERS go back and recalculate the distribution for 1999. And what that will mean is that the employers will be required to pony up the additional amounts that are credited back to employer accounts. And it will also mean, if they do that, that people who retired since 1999 will have to have their accounts, their benefits recalculated. It will be a mess.
Yes, Senator Burford.
I met with some of the people involved in this and talked to the governor about it, and we are setting up a group, just like Malone Hall, that's going to try to determine a remedy that we can do legislatively rather than our system. So that's the process.
That's good to hear. I think before us today is the very narrow issue of to whether or not to approve the administrative rule report as prepared and submitted to us by Mr. Hendricks.
So moved.
Senator Minnis has moved that we approve ARR 17504. Is there any further discussion?
Chair,
yes,
Leader Williams. Do I have a conflict since I am involved in PERS?
As a class.
No, my analysis would be you don't, but with our dutiful legislative counsel sitting next to me, I will allow him to render that opinion.
Thank you, Paul Great, our community chair.
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, I think that the class of people involved in this issue is sufficiently large that you wouldn't need to declare a potential conflict of interest, but given that you even thought of it, it would be prudent for you to do so.
Well, okay. I'd like to declare an eternal and a lifetime conflict of interest in terms of PERS, and so I'd like to do that. Just, is that all right, Chair?
Senator, you can declare anything you want. And the chair notes that you have declared that conflict. I will not be declaring one because my understanding of the rules are that the class is broad enough that it does not require our individual declarations of conflict of interest. But to the extent any other member wishes to be noted on that declaration, please so signify. Hearing none, Senator Minnis has moved the adoption of 17504 Administrative Rule Report. Is there any further discussion? Any objection? The report's adopted. Thank you, David, for your work on that issue. These will be, I think we'll move through most of these quick. I think we have one other with a little more detail on it. But at this point now, we'll move on to 17538.
Mr. Taylor, involving the Department of Consumer Business Services and Electrical Safety Standards.
Hello again.
Hello, Mr. Taylor.
Chuck Taylor, Deputy Legislative Counsel. This is a DCBS Building Codes Division rule, and it deals with electrified fixed guideway passenger railway systems. Read that to mean Portland streetcar, Metro Max lines, that type of thing. We have a single statute that allows Building Codes Division to regulate those systems. The rule in question provided for a civil penalty to be levied for violations of the statute or rules that are authorized by the statute. The statute itself doesn't make any provision for a civil penalty. There is a general DCBS penalty authority for certain listed statutes, but the railway system statute is not among those listed. So basically, we don't have any statutory authority for a civil penalty here. The department is going to rescind the civil penalty provision in the rule and rely on other enforcement mechanisms. They will, as a side note, have civil penalty authority starting in January because the Assembly did amend that civil penalty statute.
So this will be a short period of time then, Mr. Taylor, that they'll be without that authority?
Right.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any discussion or questions, Mr. Taylor? Hearing none, Senator Minnis moves the adoption of ARR 17538. Is there any discussion on the report? Any objection? It's adopted. Thank you, Mr. Taylor. We'll move now to ARR 17542. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Mr. Conley's area involving the real estate agency.
Good morning, Mr. Conley.
Good morning. Chair Williams, members, this is a rule that relates to reciprocal licensing of out-of-state real estate licensees. There are about five or six categories of real estate licensees in this state. Those are listed in ORS 696.025. What the statute says about reciprocal licensing is that when the real estate agency licenses an out-of-state real estate licensee, they shall have the same category of license in this state that they have in the other state. The rule with respect to associate real estate licensees and real estate salesperson says that an out-of-state person in one of those categories, in either of those categories, will be treated as a salesperson in this state. The agency has agreed with my interpretation that that rule does not follow the statute, and Brian DeMarco from the real estate agency is actually here in the audience, and so I guess I would allow him, ask him to come up and tell you how the agency intends to respond,
Brian,
for the determination.
We have a letter in your materials, Mr. DeMarco. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Chair Williams, members of the committee, legislative council. My name is Brian DeMarco. I'm the assistant commissioner at the Oregon Real Estate Agency. Essentially, Senate Bill 446, now Oregon Laws Chapter 300, has changed the entire licensing system to a single licensing concept. As such, we're going to be in the process of revising new rules, of which this rule would be one. The Senate Bill 446 repealed the enabling legislation, ORS 696258, and amended 696265. So we're in a new ball game here. The problem is the effective date of the legislation is January 2001. However, the operative date of the legislation is not until July 2001, in the 6-month period in which to deal with these rule changes. However, I will a temporary rule deleting this subsection so that it can conform to recommendations of the Legislative Council.
Right. So you'll do the gap filler with the temporary rule until the new statute goes online. Okay. Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. DeMarco? Thanks. We appreciate you being here. Senator Minnis moves the adoption of Administrative Rule Report 17542. Is there any further discussion? Any objection? Adopted. We'll move now to 17552. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That involves the Economic and Community Development Department, and Mr. Conley is here for that one, too.
Mr. Conley.
Chair Williams, members, this rule relates to regional and rural investment planning. The statutes, I believe, ORS 285B.230 contains a definition of region. A region is a group of counties either designated by the Economic and Community Development Department or recognized by a regional partnership. The administrative rules allow for regions to consist of portions of counties, or in the case where some portion of a county had been left out, a portion of a single county. Several references in the statute refer to groups of counties. As I mentioned, those groups of counties are either designated by the department or recognized by a regional partnership. There does not seem to be anything in the statute that allows for portions of counties to form regions. You do have a letter in your packet from the agency. They disagree with my analysis. Their disagreement is largely on policy grounds. They seem to believe that regions do not necessarily follow county lines. While I wouldn't necessarily disagree with them about that policy choice, the statutory definition of region does not allow them to make that policy choice.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Conley?
In short, what this means is that because the statute refers to groups of counties, it means that multiple counties could form a region, but that you could not take a portion of one county and a portion of another county to form an economic development region. Is that your
That is my reading of the statute.
Right.
I would mention, if you're looking at the copy of their response that's in your file, down near the bottom, they have cited to, they've essentially quoted ORS 285B236(3). And you see the ellipsis there in the middle of that quotation. Essentially, after states that, that is the exact wording of the statute. Well, the language that they have eliminated is, a region shall consist of at least two contiguous counties.
Right. The sort of important language at this thing. I don't think any of us necessarily disagree that maybe the Economic and Community Development Department ought to have the authority to organize these regions, and that they might not necessarily require entire counties. As a policy issue, that's something that maybe the legislature ought to think about giving them in the next session, but it does seem that the rule falls outside of the statutory authority. And again, our sole determination here today is whether to adopt the administrative rules report and then let them decide what their next step is going to be. Any further discussion? Hearing none, Senator so Courtney moves the adoption
I move it.
Of ARR
I move it.
17552. Is there any discussion on his motion? Any objection? Hearing none, the report is adopted. Thank you, Mr. Conley. We have done 17573 when we addressed the fire marshals, both temporary and permanent rule. So we're now to the last one, ARR 17598.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this involves the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training, which is normally an area that Virginia Vanderbilt would cover. She's on a well-deserved family trip. And as a result, we'll also be missing the presentation of her award for 15 years service to the office, but we will capture her for that another time. In her stead, Mary Ann Milligan is here to present the report.
Hi, Mary Ann.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Ann Milligan, staff attorney here for Virginia Vanderbilt. The legislature has authorized the Public Safety Memorial Fund Board to provide benefits to family members of public safety officers who are killed or injured under certain circumstances. And the statute specifically provides that a family member of a public safety officer who is killed while off duty and interceding in a crime is eligible for benefits. But the rule has omitted this provision relating to an officer who is killed while off duty and interceding in a crime. So the extent that the rule does not provide for this class of person, that's the problem with this particular part of the rule. There's another problem in that the statute also provides that a person is not eligible for benefits if the person's actions were a substantial contributing factor to the death or disability of a public safety officer. And the rule, however, provides that a person is not eligible if the public safety officer's actions were a substantial contributing factor. So the best example of the problem would be that under the statute, if a wife of a public safety officer were a substantial contributing factor to that officer's injury or death, under the statute, she would not be eligible, but under the rule, she would be eligible for the award. So that's a problem, that the rule does not disqualify certain class of persons that the statute does. And it's my understanding that Virginia Vanderbilt had a conversation with Bill Farr from the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training last, I think, Thursday, indicated that he agreed with both of these problems, and realized they were problems and that they would be changed. But we have not received a response from them as of about a half an hour ago.
Okay. Are there any questions on this issue? Yes.
Question, what happened this last couple of days where the officer in Albany was off duty and was not involved in a crime but helping a disabled voter? How would that affect that particular?
You know, I don't know. I think the problem with this is that I don't think he was interceding in a crime. So, in this under the statute, he was off duty and interceding in a crime. But the other part of the statute, which is not at issue here, is if he's while on duty.
He was not on duty.
They weren't on duty?
The Albany officer was not.
The Albany officer was not.
I have a copy of the statute here, but I don't.
Well, if it's not a crime, then it wouldn't be covered.
Yeah, that may be an issue we want to address. Police officer memorial statute is new since, I think, was it the 99 session, I think, that we adopted it?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, we didn't, not all circumstances were potentially considered, so that may be an issue that we want to consider addressing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Durfler, I don't know if that is covered under the statute.
Well, I think the committee would be interested, counsel. Maybe if you want to have somebody take a look at that and just let us know, even informally in the next day or two, I think we'd probably want to know that just so we know a little bit more about the available benefits to the families of those officers.
In some ways, Mr. Chair, law enforcement people are never off duty in a way, if you stop and think about it. I mean, I think that would be our feeling or my perception in some way. You'd want them to come forward at a critical time, I thought we sort of had these conversations, John, in our last session involving that situation that the officer, that was a crime situation, was assisting, as you remember, and he got killed, he got shot at, and we sort of dealt with this issue. It was a crime situation, it was off duty, and it was a death penalty type of issue.
Mm-hmm. Senator?
Just one other thing, and there are some federal benefits available to officers killed in the line of duty.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that definition is under federal statute. But.
Well, is that whether they're on duty or not?
This is a good question. In the line of duty, as Senator Courtney points out, oftentimes police officers take official police action or involved in official police action, which they have authority to do while they're not within the scope of their 8-hour shift or 10-hour shift. That's considered to be in the line of duty.
Which may be a more appropriate standard. We just ought to take a look at that and certainly consider possible changes if there isn't coverage there. I think that's a worthy discussion. Anything else? Okay. I need a motion on ARR 17598.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Courtney moves the adoption of ARR 17598. Is there any further discussion? Any objection? The report is adopted. Thank you, Mary Ann. And now we move to the last item of business, which is presentation of the Service Recognition Awards. Council.
Mr. Chair, thank you, members of the committee. As you've noticed from your own service in the legislature, the most valuable commodity is experience. It is a commodity like the legislative assembly that we have had some loss of in recent years. Our office has less than one-third the experience that it had 3.5 years ago. Part of the reason for that is the work in the office is extremely hard, and it's extremely hard on families and friends. Those willing to devote their careers, or at least large parts of it, to service in the office are therefore worth giving some special recognition to, which is what this portion of the program is for. A common factor that you will see is that it's typical for employees to start with us as a session hire and then become a continuing member of the staff, so that a person will have been with legislative counsel for more years than their award may indicate, because their service may not have been continuous. Not all the recipients are here, and we will get them at the next meeting that they're available. Lori Grady, team leader of the publication specialists, and Virginia Vanderbilt, our criminal law expert, are due to receive 15-year awards, but are out of the office. We're just about to begin as I mentioned, an extremely busy period of time putting together the Oregon Revised Statutes, and this is a short window in which they can go visit some family members. I'm pleased, however, to have first three people to receive awards for 5 years service to the office. The first is Mike McKay. Mike started as a session editor and is now a senior editor. He supervises the session editors and has key responsibilities in preparing our legal publications such as the Oregon Revised Statutes. He's in his fourth session, and when he's not spotting corrections in legal documents, he spends his time helping others to the coast spot migrating whales. Mike, thank you very much for devoting your time to us, and you have to come up and get your...
Come up and get your award.
Thanks. Pat Wickham started with us in 1996 as a session publication specialist, and she is now our workflow coordinator, which is our equivalent of the air traffic controller. She supervises the people who make sure all the various pieces of paper get to where they're supposed to do, which, one, given that there's so much paper, is quite a task, and two, given that we have to keep track of it on large sheets of paper, is a testament to Pat's skills and concentration and organization. At least from our office's perspective, however, her most significant achievement or ability is her good relations with the chief clerk. And for that, we're quite appreciative. Thank you very much for spending so much time with us.
Thank you.
Next is Judy Howard. Judy started almost 10 years ago working for us in workflow and has worked basically ever since part-time doing whatever it is we needed doing. She knows more about what goes on in the various parts of the office than just about anybody else, and is wonderful to be able to assign when the people need help in a particular area. She's just sort of our designated troubleshooter, and one of her best assets is being able to tell when morale in the office is in most need of a boost, and then baking some concoction, cookies, whatever, to help with that morale. So, Judy, thank you very much. Then, for 15 years service, Deborah Cook. Deborah started 20 years ago with the Office of Legislative Counsel as a session word processor because she needed money for college tuition. She's risen through the ranks, basically all of them, and is now our administrative services manager, where she handles everything from the budget to personnel matters to the sales of publications, and ultimately will be the person who makes sure that you get your per diem payment. I asked Deb, as I asked Ted, the folks who've been here getting 15 year awards, what they saw as the most significant change in that time. What Deb reported was that members keep getting younger. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As an aside about Young, one of the tasks that the chair assigned me, in which I've been working on for some weeks now, is reading all of the amendments that have ever been made to the Oregon Constitution. And while it's been an interesting legal historical adventure, it's also interesting from sort of a personal historical standpoint, in that I've had to look through all of the voters' pamphlets over the years, including one I read recently in which there was a young legal aid lawyer, then age 29, running for the position of Salem City Alderman. And it was
former Boston resident. And
yeah. it was interesting to see some familiar faces in quite different contexts.
Quite different hair color, too, I'm sure.
I still have personality.
The final recipient of our 15-year award goes to Ted Reutlinger, who has spent most of his legal career with our office. He is our guru of elections, ethics, and redistricting, and as such spends a great deal of time dealing with questions that are most near and dear to your hearts. I asked him what was his most interesting anecdote from the past 15 years, and he reported that he couldn't come up with one because he's just been a bump on a log. I also asked him what the most significant change was that he'd seen in the past 15 years, and I thought his response was interesting. It's that over the years, the attorneys in our office get less and less personal contact with members in the crafting of their legislation, that members over the years are more and more delegating that work, the work of making legislation, to their staffers and to the lobby, and doing less of that work themselves. So, something to think about. Thank you very much, Ted, for enduring it. That concludes the portion of the program that I'd intended to subject you to.
I just want to say that I can tell that Senator Courtney wants to say something, and we'll let anybody else say what they want to say. But certainly we appreciate all the service that each of you have rendered during the last legislative session. You often work in anonymity, and you know that. We know that, too, and I appreciate Greg allowing us to participate in this recognition of your long service and important service to the committee, because it gets us more familiar with many of you who we see often when we're down there but don't always know exactly what your job is. What we know is that in the end you make the things come out right and you make us look better because of the work you do, and I know that each member of the legislature appreciates your hard work and your dedicated service to the people of the state of Oregon, and I mean that with all sincerity. Senator Courtney.
Well, I was going to be a little bit different, so you ruined my mood. I can't say that. That was a very nice thing you said. And what I was going to say is I've been around here a while, and I've worked with him personally, day and night, night and day, and I've said very nice things to them in their offices, and very nice things to them when they come before committees. I even said nice things about your dog, Mr. Chamo. When am I going to get an award from Legislative Council? I don't know, Legislative Council, but when am I going to get an award? I mean, I'm just like I'm an extension of LC in a way, so but when do I get an award?
You're an extension of something, Senator. Senator President Durfer, would you have any comments?
Well, I think that, from my viewpoint, the Legislative Council did an outstanding job this past session. I think that, again, I guess I'll have to say it. In the previous session, I thought we had some problems that have been all corrected, and I think that you have just done an outstanding job for all of us this time. We appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you very much, Chair Williams. I want to thank all of you for your diligence and your hard work, the early mornings and late nights. I know that during the session and the press of business that goes on, all the bills that have to be drafted, the record number of bills this time that we, I think, were quite successful in culling down to a modest number to pass. A huge workload. They all have to be drafted. They all have to be approved. They all have to be prepped, and that burden falls on your shoulders, and you did it quite admirably this year. And you have a high standard of work, and your dedication. I just personally appreciate it very, very much. And I just want to say thank you.
Anybody else?
Mr.
Yes, Senator Minnis.
Well, you know, in the years I've been here since 1985, almost a little bit longer than Ted was here, one thing I appreciate is the professionalism of the office throughout the years, because I know I presented some pretty doggone dumb ideas from time to time. and trying to get them to tell me that is very hard. You know? I've actually walked and said, "Will you please just tell me if you think this is a stupid idea?" And they always rise to, you know, a higher level. I was like, "No, no, we can consider this, you know, but you might want to think about it a little bit different way." And I really do appreciate the fact that they respect the institution of the legislature and the position of various legislators and facilitate our work, because you do make us look good. You really do. And it's been a tremendous education for me in this process. I appreciate it very much.
Anyone else? Representative Walker.
Well, as a first-termer, having been here only 8 months, that pales next to the experience that's sitting out here. I'd like to say thank you very much for the lifeline that you extended to those of us that are learning. You're wonderful. Thank you.
Chair Lundquist, I guess in all seriousness, I don't think there's a better law firm in the state of Oregon than Legislative Council.
I'm conflicted out in commenting on that, Senator, but I think they're pretty darn good. Okay. All right. With that, we will adjourn the meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to